This is an ABC podcast.
Last week, Conversations travelled to Perth for the Writers' Festival, and my guest at the festival was Deepak Unnikrishnan. Deepak grew up in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. Abu Dhabi is a city built on the edge of the desert. It juts out into the Persian Gulf with a skyline full of high-rises and mega malls. The people who build those high-rises and the roads and the houses are mainly foreign workers. They make up a staggering 80% of the population of the UAE. And no matter how long these workers live in Abu Dhabi, they can never become citizens. Once they lose a job or retire, they're sent back to whatever country they came from. Deepak's parents came to Abu Dhabi from India. Growing up, he knew that once he turned 18, he'd have to be sponsored by an employer to stay in his hometown, or he'd be sent to India, a country he hardly knew. Deepak managed to manufacture a third option for himself. He went off to study in the USA. And while living in the States, Deepak published his debut collection of stories in a book called Temporary People. Temporary People is all about living somewhere that doesn't really want you. And in this conversation, Deepak occasionally uses a bit of salty language to express how a life like that feels. This is my conversation with Deepak Unnikrishnan, recorded in front of an audience at the Perth Writers' Festival. Deepak, can we begin, please, with you reading to us from the first story in your collection, Golf Return?
I feel like I have to leave the room because I was just extraordinary. Thank you. Right, the first chapter is called Golf Return. I should explain the phrase. My parents are from Kerala in India, and when they leave, that's basically what they're called. Golf Return. So that the voice sounds sexy. In a labor camp, somewhere in the Persian Gulf, a laborer swallowed his passport and turned into a passport. His roommate swallowed a suitcase and turned into a little suitcase. When the third roommate, privy and vital to the master plan, ran away the next morning with the new suitcase and passport, he made it past the guard on night duty, onto the morning bus to the airport, past the bored ticket agent at check-in, past security, past pat-down and a rummage through his suitcase, past using the bathroom once, twice, thrice, to pee, to shit, to sit, past duty-free where he stared at chocolates and booze and magazines and currencies, past families eating fast food in tracksuits or designer wear, past men and women sleeping on the floor, past his past, past his present, past the gold in the souks, the cranes in the sky, petrol in the air, dreams in his head, past God and the devil, the smell of mess halls, past humidity and hot air, past it all, until he found an empty chair in the departures lounge where he sat and held his future in his hands. It was then the little suitcase sprouted legs and ears, and the passport developed palms and long fingers, as well as a nose and a mustache. And as soon after the boarding call, at the very moment the stewardess checked his documents, the third labourer was asked to wait.
Wonderfully evocative images of people turning into passports and into suitcases. And there's that whole great tradition in literature from Kafka of men waking up and discovering that there's something else. How did that story start for you? Did it begin as an image or as an idea?
I'm not really sure. I mean, Kafka's the master and I'm an amateur. But I think what happened is The Guardian had published a piece about workers a few years ago, probably in 2012. And I went to sleep, because this was my master's thesis at the Art Institute of Chicago. And my teacher, Deborah Unferth, had homework for us, which is basically write a story about lists. And I didn't know what to do. Like laundry list, grocery list, I didn't really know what to do. And when I went to sleep, I had a dream about someone in a labor camp. So I woke up and I wrote this in 3 or 4 hours, the only story I've written in 3 or 4 hours. And it just flowed. But I think it's because of the music behind the sentences, because when I was writing it, it went, and, you know, you could just write, and that's how it came to me, and I think it works, but depends.
As you say, it's your dad who first came to Abu Dhabi. What brought him there?
Well, my father needed work. He was in Bombay at the time, and he wanted to make more money. So he applied for a position in the Trucial States, which is what the UAE was called at the time, a British protectorate. And he applied by mail, not email, mail. And then he waited. I think he waited almost a year, maybe more. And then he received a response saying, come on over.
What work did he do?
So he was trained as an engineer. He had a diploma in that. He worked for a telecommunications company. I really don't know what he did because I've tried asking him, and my father belongs to a very macho sentiment where he doesn't talk. He's not very tactile. So he told me he worked for the telecommunications company. But I think it was customer service. That's what he did for 40 years or so.
And he had, although he was living in Bombay, he'd grown up in Kerala. What kind of place is Kerala?
So for those of you who have never been, imagine you've landed in a space and you've decided to pee. And then after 2 minutes, something grows. That's Kerala. I'm not saying, you smell urine when you land. But what I am saying is it's lush and it's green and you smell things. And everything feels as though it makes sense. The desert, which is where my father went to, I mean, he didn't camp out in the desert, but that's what the UAE is, desert country. It's completely different. It's at the extremity. So he left a space where people just took things for granted as far as greenery was concerned, and then he went to a place or a space where it was prized.
And what about your mum? She spent time in Kerala, but also in Africa. How did that happen?
Yeah, so my mum was raised in Kenya for a little bit. I think until she was 10 or 12, my grandparents were there.
Why were they in Kenya?
My grandpa used to work for the British Embassy. So my aunt and uncle were there as well. And then when they were 12 or 13, they were sent back, or returned, as we say, to Kerala, where my mother spent, I think, 5 or 6 years before she married my father. And then she moved again.
So was she from quite a high-class family if they were working with the embassy?
High-class in the sense that my grandfather could leave, like they had land, so they were certainly privileged. But my father came from a family that weren't as privileged. So I think for my mother it's sort of strange because when she grew up there was a sense that money was available. But as she grew older, it was as though money wasn't there. So she went from one extreme to the other, you could say.
How well did your mum and dad know one another before they got married?
I have no idea. They probably didn't know much of each other. It was an arranged marriage. And they sort of got to know each other over time. I don't think they knew each other at all.
So did she come from Kerala to Abu Dhabi to marry him?
Yeah, they got married in Kerala and then she followed my father to Abu Dhabi. Yeah.
And how long before little Deepak came along?
Well, I think I was conceived in Abu Dhabi, although if you ask my mother that, she'd probably blush. A couple of years later, maybe 3 or 4, I'm not really sure. But I was born in 1980 in December. My mother had me in Kerala, though.
And as a first-born son, Deepak, does that mean you were something of a golden child in
your
family?
Yeah, I was king of the land. I was the first-born on my father's and my mother's side. So in other words, people came to see me, and I hadn't even learned to speak
yet. As they
yet.
Still do.
Yeah, that. Exactly. Thank you very much. But people came to see me, and not only was I the first born in both sides, I was also the son, which meant something. But then my grandfather was also there in Abu Dhabi. So yeah, I was certainly prized and spoiled.
What kind of relationship did you have with your granddad?
I remember him. He was, I think, 3 when he passed away in Abu Dhabi, but I rarely remember him. I remember his voice. I remember he was my father. I mean, my father didn't count. I remember when my father tried to pick me up, I'd cry so Grandpa would take me. And I remember that after he died, we had to take the coffin back to India, because that's what you did. He died in Abu Dhabi. So the 6-month period between taking him back, the cremation and everything else, the grieving and the mourning period, I don't remember any of that. It's just black. And then I remember Grandma coming because she was depressed and she needed to get away. So I remember him.
So your family could return to Kerala when there was a funeral or a wedding, but apart from that, how regularly would they go home?
Well, I would sort of qualify that because you could return if you had the money to go. Nowadays, when you think of an aircraft is like a bus. you know, you have discounted tickets and whatnot. Back in the day, when I say back in the day, I'm not 104 years old. But, you know, in the 80s and certainly in the 90s, it was quite a luxury to get on an aircraft. So you needed the money to go. For my parents, it was, I think, once every 2 years if they could afford it. But after my grandparents and my great-grandmother passed away, it was much longer.
And what was keeping them in Abu Dhabi? Why were they staying there?
I mean, in the beginning, it was work, adventure, because my parents were young, you know, and they'd just gotten married. And so you have that sense of adventure when you're that young. And then I came along, and my sister came along. And then there's responsibility. You feel as though you owe it to the kids. I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of my parents. Hopefully, I'm right. Because the kids are there, you want to stay because you want to give them the education that they've sort of earned. That's what you tell yourself as a parent. And then as they get older, you feel as though you need more money in your kitty to build a house that you've always wanted to build when you return. But my parents never had money. So because they never had money, they were sort of trapped, sort of stuck. And then I think there's also the love for a place or a country. Because being somewhere isn't just about cash. Being somewhere is about comfort. Comfort in sounds, comfort in food, comfort and familiarity, that you open the door and you hear your son or your daughter.
Describe Abu Dhabi to me as someone who's never been there. What's it like as a city?
Depends on who you ask. I was raised there for the first 20 years of my life. So if you had met me in the States when I was that old, I would have told you Abu Dhabi is all I know. Abu Dhabi is the sound of my mother, the sound of my father, the sound of my irritating sister. Abu Dhabi is the sound of cricket, the sound of football, the sound of school. But Abu Dhabi is also a place where I can just be. Yet, Abu Dhabi is also a place of impermanence, where you always think about departure, which is imminent, no matter how old you are. And that's how I felt Abu Dhabi was when I was 20. Now, at the ripe old age of whatever you think I am, Abu Dhabi is the place where my parents used to live. Abu Dhabi is the place where my grandpa took me to the Corniche. Abu Dhabi is where you have buildings, where you have the desert, where you have heat, where you have humidity. And Abu Dhabi is everything else that I haven't covered in those three or four sentences. Because I'm not Abu Dhabi. I can't be. So Abu Dhabi is in the press that you read, where you read about workers, where you read about bling and flashy cars and sheikhs. But Abu Dhabi is also about stories that you don't hear about. You began this conversation by addressing ancestors, addressing people who are no longer here, paying your respects. Abu Dhabi is that too. You'll never read about some people when you go there because their stories aren't written. Or if you don't meet someone who don't talk about certain people, it's as though they don't exist. In fact, the actual response to your question is, how much time do you have?
Give me a more prosaic answer in terms of if I was to walk outside an air-conditioned hotel in Abu Dhabi, what would confront me?
You would confront a city that thinks it's quite beautiful, but if you believe urban space needs to have skyscrapers and glass and steel, you would call it an ugly city. But you'll also be confronted by people from everywhere. You'll be confronted by languages. When I say confronted, you'll hear it. You'll hear Hindi, you'll hear Urdu, you'll hear Arabic. And even in Arabic, you'll hear Khaliji, which is, you know, the Arabic spoken by people of the Gulf, Shami. You will hear Tagalog. You will hear Nepali. You will hear languages you cannot identify, and that'll fuck you over because, like, what is that? And that's important. You will be surprised. At the same time, you will sort of hear the weather. And here's what I mean by that. If you visit now, you'll enjoy it. If you come in July and August, you won't.
Why?
Simply because this is the best explanation that I've heard from a colleague of mine who's from Denmark. And he's been living in Abu Dhabi for around 6 or 7 years. And I said, you see, Deepak, when I landed at the airport, I walked outside. And then he waited a beat and said, I thought it was raining. And this was summer. It was the humidity. It's like 85 to 90%. You're drenched. But at the same time, you realize that this is a place that you don't completely understand. If you speak to the Emiratis or tribesmen who remember the days from the 50s and the 60s, they'll talk to you about other things. They can talk to you about the desert in ways I cannot possibly understand. because they see things. People nowadays, when they think of Abu Dhabi, because you wanted a more specific answer, you see the buildings, you see architecture, you see glitz, you see the future. But if you look close enough, if you take your time with it, you will see the past.
How does the fact that the city is on the edge of the desert affect the character of the place and of the people?
And it depends, because, you know, when you're a kid, you take certain things for granted. Like when you go indoors, you assume everything has to be frigid. And then you go to India when you have what my parents would call power cuts, which is basically the electricity goes off for a couple of hours or days. You realize it's a privilege to have that experience where you don't feel like you're burning. And you talk about character. You have individuals who have left their families and who are living there for decades. To be able to live without remembering your loved ones long enough so that you can exist is a test of character. To be able to work for someone's future, your children or your wife's or even your husband's, without a guarantee that you will see them long enough for them to appreciate what you've done, is character. To be able to enjoy privileges, if you are of, say, the upper echelons of the class system in Abu Dhabi, then you will get to go to your five-star restaurants and hotels, go home three or four times a year. I'm not sure if that's a test of character, but that breeds a certain kind of character too. Depends on where you are. It really depends on where you live. Depends on what you want.
If you're walking through the streets of the city, are there green spaces?
Absolutely. Sheikh Zayed, who was the founder of the Federation, believed in that, conservation and anything that was green. And in fact, he was militant about it. So Abu Dhabi is greener than you think. So, you know, you land expecting to see camels and deserts and petrol barrels. I'm sorry to disappoint you. You get that, but you also get trees. You know, you also see water. You also realize that things must have been pretty fucking terrible like 60, 70 years ago. Now it's different.
Is it a city good for walking then?
See, that's an interesting question because I've had this conversation with individuals who've visited. And usually their commentary goes something like this: you can't walk here, so it's really not a city. And then I go, why? Because you come from Paris and Berlin and elsewhere where walking is not a chore, but can really be appreciated? Or I ask, why, based on the fact that you have a bunch of malls here? But people walk in malls too. You know, malls are urban spaces. They're not incredibly sexy spaces, but they're urban spaces. But I used to walk as a kid, not because I enjoy being a flaneur. We didn't have money to take the taxi. And then when we did, we took the taxi. My father, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, he worked the morning shift. So he had to get to work at 7 a.m. So he'd put on his shirt, his tie, his pants, shoes. And then if there wasn't enough money in the house for him to take the taxi, which was cheap in Abu Dhabi at the time, he would walk. He'd walk 15, 20 minutes to get to where he needed to go. Then he'd walk on his way back at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And when he walked into the house, I could smell him. I could smell him, I could smell the shirt, I could smell what he had done. But I never understood it. Because I was a kid, I was a brat. You know, my father's supposed to come home and give me money so I can go play in the arcades. As an adult, you sort of contemplate and reflect on what your father did for you. So he walked because he had to. And to this day, I walk a lot. I don't drive, by the way, because I'm a terrible driver. But I think I walk for a reason, because it helps me remember.
What was the apartment like that your dad would return home to?
It was a one-bedroom space. There was my mother, there was me, there was my sister. And then later, there was a dog. So it was the four of us.
Where did you all sleep?
I slept in the living room. The dog slept next to my face. My parents and my sisters slept in what we'd call the bedroom. And that was it. It was normal. It wasn't, you know, we didn't romanticize it. We didn't talk about sacrifice. That's what it was. It was okay. We were all right. We weren't necessarily happy, but we had each other, which I think was important.
Did you know other families in the apartment block? Was your situation similar to other families?
Absolutely. I mean, there were families that could afford the two- or three-bedroom house, And there were others where you had two or three families in a two or three bedroom house. And in other apartments or flats, you had individuals, six or seven of them, sharing the apartment, and they were from different places. But they sort of, then that's what they need to do in order to survive.
Where did you play as a kid? I can't imagine there was much space in that apartment.
Everywhere. When you're a kid, you don't care because you appropriate spaces and places. It's as you grow older and you're told there are rules, then you get a little bit more hesitant or reticent. So, you know, to answer your question specifically, so back in the day, buildings were right next to each other. So you had little pockets of space in between. We'd look at that and go, football. Or someone else would look at that and go, cricket. Or someone else will look at that and go, I'm going to learn how to be Michael Jordan right there. And all of these imaginations of space was crucial and important because we couldn't afford the fancy clubs and whatnot. So it worked for us, so everywhere.
You have a story in Temporary People about a street game of soccer that goes wrong. What happens in that story?
So it's called Municipality. But Municipality is basically what we say when we are lazy with our English. The actual word is municipality, but we'd say municipality because it made sense. You know, we were kids, come on.
When I read that chapter, I thought, oh, here's a strange Hindu term I've never heard before.
Yeah, no, it's not Sanskrit, it's not Urdu, it's basically the mangling of English when kids are lazy. And so the municipality, the Abu Dhabi municipality, is an urban space where you have parking lots. And when the cars leave, we go cricket, football, anything you want, anything you bloody please. So the story is about kids playing a game of football or cricket and then enjoying the space and at the same time being really aware of the rules. So they're always watchful of, say, here's an Arabic word, shurta, which is police, because you're not allowed to do that. So as we would play, you know, we would have a lookout who would be fielding at the same time watching out for the patrol car. And when he would see the car sort of slinking in, you know, like a jaguar or a leopard, he'd go, shurta, and then we'd all run. But that was part of the game, you know, because we had to be, maybe this is why I'm very good at airports, because I'm always watchful. Is anyone looking at me?
What might police do with a group of kids who are playing soccer?
It depends. If they're kind, they would ask you to scram. If they're not, they would take your cricket bat or your football. If they really want to be terrifying, they'd call one of you over and ask you to get in to the car. So we've had all three experiences. And, you know, sometimes it's not about what they do, it's what you think they will do. It really isn't about reality. It's about a future that you're hesitant to sort of contemplate. And your kids. And that's what the story is about, really contemplation and reflection.
How much contact did you have with local Emiratis growing up?
Not much. In fact, I never spoke to an Emirati properly until I started teaching.
You never spoke to? No.
I mean, it's not malicious or anything. It's just that, you know, I went to an Indian school in Abu Dhabi where I was trained to be an Indian. So in every morning we'd have the Indian national anthem and we'd stand to attention. We'd have the Emirati national anthem, stand to attention. But then the community that I lived in was mainly South Asians and other Arab communities, because by then locals had been shifted elsewhere because their housing was subsidized. It made sense to them. So then in order to venture out to our parts, they needed to do something there. And when you're a kid, you know, I just hung out with people who looked like me because there was comfort in that. There was safety in that.
Were you aware as a kid of the huge wealth that existed in other pockets of the city?
When your family doesn't have much money, you're always aware of wealth. You pay attention. You pay attention to what you cannot have. You pay attention to what you cannot get. But the perfect response to your question is to weave ambition into the sentence. My ambition was capped. And what I mean by that is I knew there were certain things I could not do because we didn't have money. I knew there were certain things I could not be because I didn't have money. And I knew there were certain things I couldn't have access to because we didn't have money. So you are aware of wealth, but you're also aware of, you know, the proximity to information and knowledge that you couldn't possess. But I didn't completely understand that until I left. Because when you leave, you have distance. And when I say left, I mean for the States. And when you're looking back towards what is your homeland, or what is your place or your space, you're sort of allowing yourself to be frank with yourself. You can tell yourself things you didn't want to tell yourself when you were there. And I don't think that's an unusual experience. I think most of us have that. It's just that for me, I was 20 when I had mine.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
As a kid walking the streets or playing soccer in car parks, were there things that you'd see that brought home to you the different realities in that city?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have to say, every time you say soccer, I feel like I have to do something. It's football, damn it. No, it's not. But sure, and I think what happens is when you see people who look like you doing things that feel normal and they're comfortable with the act of playing, but you also realize that there are other things that they're thinking about and not talking about. For instance, if, as you said, an Emirati gentleman were to pass us by, we would stop playing because we weren't sure what to do. And, you know, I'm using a generic we. I should say I would stop playing because I felt as though this person should know I'm respectful. But that's a reflexive action, something that we were trained to sort of think about and do ever since we were kids, to be respectful towards your hosts, to ensure that they know that you're grateful. And I'm all for that. But a consequence of that is also deference. You end up being deferential.
So you're conscious of this place that you had grown up in as being a visitor, that they were your hosts?
From the very beginning. But we were okay with it. Because like I said earlier, you know, you're told since you're a little boy that you will have to leave, that we will have to leave, that we will have to go. So what you do is you're in this realm of perpetual impermanence. It's an in-between realm. But in order to function, you can't think too far ahead into the future. You have to think about the present.
Explain more to me, Deepak, how that visa system works, how this temporariness is kind of a core part of what it is to be a foreigner in Abu Dhabi.
So in Abu Dhabi, if you're not Emirati, what happens is if you have a job, you're allowed to stay. If your family is wedded to your work, your family is allowed to stay. But you need to make a certain amount of money in order for your family to stay. The minute you don't have a job, like in the case of my father, the minute you retire, or you have to retire if you're a government employee, depending on what your age is, the family visa is cancelled as well. And so you have to prepare yourself for departure. If you're a boy, as I was, the minute you turn 18... if you're not wedded to work or a university or school, your residence visa is cancelled. If you're a girl, if your parent is still working and you turn 18, you're okay as long as the parent is working. So the rules are different depending on what your circumstances are. But my family was privileged to have family around. You know, I've had uncles who lived in the Gulf for decades who didn't have my aunts next to them or their children next to them, because they made a decision to not bring them over, or they weren't making enough money to sort of say, come on over. So it really depends.
So those rules are for any foreign-born worker.
Absolutely.
Needs to have a current working visa to stay. There's no residency. Is it possible ever to become a citizen?
Not that I know of. They're changing the laws a little bit. So you're allowed to sort of apply for permanent residency now. But the stipulations are, in my opinion, and I say this respectfully, for the elites. Because you have to own property, have a certain amount of money in the bank, and then you're okay. But, you know, that makes me think. So if you don't make a certain amount of money, then you will need to leave. So that system is still in place. However, I also have to say the system is blunt. It's quite transparent. You know what you're signing yourself up for. And there are no lies when you arrive. The rules of arrival are very clear. What's a little bit more ambiguous and vague are the rules of departure. Because there's no vocabulary for trauma. There's no vocabulary or language for what it means to leave after you remain for so long. Some of us internalize it, and we're like, we know how to do this. Others are indifferent. Others struggle.
Some of the stories in temporary people look at the challenges and the struggles and the threats that happen to workers as a consequence of these arrangements. Tell me about the story Birds, which is early on in the collection.
Yeah, so when I was writing this, Birds took a long time for me to write. I'd read stories and reports in magazines and journals about construction workers, and was always slanted towards them being mistreated or them having no agency at all. And that really, really bothered me, because I've had conversations with individuals where they look at me and go, so you write about the voiceless, and that makes me very uncomfortable. I don't. If there's anything that I hope your listeners will take from this, is that I don't write about the voiceless. People have voices, they have agency. So I wanted to write something where I sort of tackled that. Where sure, you know, things are shitty sometimes, but what do you do when you stop being a construction worker? What if your name is Muhammad or Ram and your shift has just ended? What do you do for fun? You know, who do you love? You know, do you like parrots? Why do you like parrots? Do you like milk? Why do you like milk? Do you like Bob Dylan? Why do you like Bob Dylan? These matter. And importantly, do you have a name? What is your name? Who gave you that name? What is the story behind that name? And these matter simply because then you sort of distance yourself from the profession and you look at these individuals as they are, as human beings. And so to do that, I struggled because I don't have a background in literature. So I sort of had to teach myself. So I thought of looking at imagery. And I remembered sounds that I remembered when I was growing up. And I wanted to incorporate sounds and imagery with birds, which is how it came to be. And I have to say, Janet Desaunier, my teacher, deserves credit, because the original title was Icarus, which is terribly boring. Birds make sense.
In that story, though, it's not just that these construction workers have a life and preferences and names beyond their job. The risk of those of their job is sort of at the core of the story. It's about a woman who goes and is patching up people who've been injured and repairing them. Yeah. So the fact of the physical risk of the work that so many people do in this place where they have no rights as workers must be something that's a constant undercurrent in the society.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, you know, it's fascinating because when we think of race car drivers or surgeons, we always think of them as risk takers. And you have tons of films made about them being risk takers. When you think of construction worker, most of us, or some of us, think of a lack of agency. But they take risks as well. It's just a different set of risks. It's probably not sexy, as Ayrton Senna was, but it's still a risk. And that risk counts. That risk matters. And, you know, I'm also of the impression that you have individuals who are not necessarily great people. They're just human beings. I fall into that category. My parents are decent. They ended up with a product like me, less decent. And I wanted to write about the less decent. I wanted to write about people who fall in between from time to time, in between realms. The realm of the decent, the less decent, and the realm of the devil.
The term pravasis comes up a lot, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Pravasi, yeah.
Pravasi.
Yeah, that's very good. God, that's very good.
What does it mean?
So pravasi means many, many things. In Malayalam, when you say pravasi to a Malayali speaker, it registers differently. And if I may, I can explain what I mean by this.
And the language that you're referring to is the language spoken in Kerala.
That's right. So the language is called Malayalam. And I'm going to read you the second paragraph from a chapter called Nalinakshi, which is the name of an old woman who's been asked by a sociologist whether she has a message for her son who works in the Gulf. And she begins this by using the word pravasi. Pravasi means foreigner, outsider, immigrant, worker. Pravasi means you've left your native place. Pravasi means you'll have regrets. You'll want money, then more money. You'll want one house with European shitters and one car, one scooter. Pravasi means you've left your loved ones because you're young, ambitious, filled with confidence that you'll be back someday. And you probably will. For a few weeks every year, you'll return for vacations. But mind you, you return older, blacker, news hungry. Before you've had time to adjust to power cuts and potholes, like they had in the old days when phones were luxuries or glued to walls, someone's going to tell you, so-and-so died. And it'll be a shock because you didn't know. And when you go to this person's house to pay your respects, you'll discover someone else has died. And as you continue to see people you know you're required to see, you'll hear about more dead people, or ailments, or needs. Then you'll see the new people, fat babies or wives or husbands, and you'll look at what they've got. Inevitably, you'll think about your own life, the choices you made, how far you've come, if paying for those shitters was worth it. And by the time you've done the math in your head, everything you've missed, what's been gained, you'll come to realize what the word pravasi really means. Absence. That's what it means. Absence. When you write your book, address my Hari, that's the name of her son, personally, and tell my beautiful, beautiful boy, tell my son that's what it's always meant. Absence.
So, what expectations did your mum and dad have of you, Deepak? What did they think you'd do as you were approaching this age of 18 where you'd have to leave or find your own visa to stay?
Nothing. I was a lazy son of a bitch.
What expectations you had of you. What did they have of you?
Well, I think my mother just wanted me to graduate and find any job and have money to be independent. I don't think they wanted me to be a writer. I didn't consider it to be a profession because to this day I consider writing to be a privilege, something that you allow yourself to do because you can. And if I may, I'll tell you the story of how I ended up being a writer. In December, I think it was 2008, my father gave me a call. I was in the States. It was early in the morning, 4 or 5. When you get a call in the morning, that early in the morning, basically what you're thinking is someone's dead. I asked him, so who died? And he said, nobody did. I said, then why are you calling me? And he said, well, I just want to let you know I won the lottery. So if you're ever at Abu Dhabi airport, they will have the Abu Dhabi duty-free raffle or lottery, which is 1 million dirhams at the time. So naturally, when my father told me this, I said, can you please put my mother on the phone? And I told her to watch him. And then I asked her, can you please put my sister on the phone? And I told my sister to watch my mother, supposed to watch my father. A couple of days after that, my father, ironed a suit, was really happy, walked out the door, received his check for 1 million dirhams, cashed it, paid all his debts, and gave me a call. 4 years to that day, I resigned and went to art school to write this book. So as far as expectations go, the expectation was to survive, to sort of be okay. But we didn't factor luck into the equation, or the fact that my father's a bloody idiot who shouldn't have been gambling away the money in the first place.
Let me be clear on this. He used his lottery winnings to put you through literature school.
No, he used his lottery winnings to pay off his debts. They had no money, but he had accrued a tremendous amount of debt. I used my savings and the scholarship I received because of the writer Sarah Levine to put myself through school. In other words, I was released from thinking about helping my family out. And I could write. For the first time in my life, I could not give a fuck. And to be in that position, you need to have a little bit of luck. So their expectations were marginal. Mine was minimal.
What about the decision to leave Abu Dhabi for the US? Why was that the place you went to?
Hopefully my parents will never listen to this. I was seeing someone and she left for New Jersey and I decided to follow her, but I didn't have the money. So I told my father that in order to pursue an intellectual education, he would have to take out a loan for a year. And the poor bastard bought it. And Yeah.
How did things turn out with that romance?
We broke up in the first 2 weeks. And so I decided now is a good opportunity to actually study because I have nothing else to do.
So you have this experience of living away for the first time. Did Abu Dhabi, was it somewhere you felt homesick for?
Yeah.
What did you miss?
Everything. You miss the banal, the ubiquitous. You see, you need to understand that that was the first time I left home. Anything that felt like home. My parents had always talked about what that felt like. I never understood it. I mean, we'd visit India and I'd still be king because I was still the oldest grandchild. But when I left Abu Dhabi, it's as though I left something behind. Memories, families. I was on the plane and I just burst into tears because I didn't know what else to do. And then when I landed in the States, I started looking for people like my parents, looking for people like me, looking for languages I understood. And I had a moment once where I heard the adhan, which is a call for prayer. And my parents raised us Hindu. It's basically, Allah, that's what you hear. And I just stopped. And the first response I had throughout was, home. And I wanted that feeling back. So I started looking for stuff in literature in English, and I couldn't find it. So I started writing in order to process my feelings. I started writing to remember, I started writing to archive, and I started telling people very specific things to questions they had. This one, for instance, which in the States is very common. Where are you from? And I'll tell them, Abu Dhabi. So what? Abu Dhabi. Okay. Next to Dubai. Yes, I know that. And then they'll ask again because of what I look like. I'm brown, I'm the color of coffee. Where are you really from? In the beginning, I'd be polite. You know, I'd tell them India. And then I got pissed off. And then I'd respond, how much time do you have? Because I was important. As I'm from Abu Dhabi. My parents are Indian. My mother grew up in Kenya. Malayalam is what we spoke at home. English is how I read, write, and think. But I have in my system Hindi, which I speak, if you give me time. I have in my system Arabic, which I read, but I can't understand or speak it. But the language makes me wobble. I have in my system Tamil, which is where Malayalam comes from. That is where I'm from. I'm from languages.
Is there something bittersweet, Deepak, about missing a place that won't let you stay?
Maybe. You know, when I was younger, there was rage because I felt that I wasn't wanted. But now, at the ripe old age of 38, I think differently. It's not bittersweet, it's something that I understand. But that doesn't necessarily mean I accept it in a way that people want me to accept things. So when, to return to your earlier question about what is Abu Dhabi like? If you ever go to Abu Dhabi and I'm not there, remember me. If you go to Abu Dhabi and I'm not there, remember my parents. If you go to Abu Dhabi and I'm not there, remember this conversation. Then we exist. So that way it's not bittersweet. It feels right then.
You were able to stay in the States to study. Why did you return back to Abu Dhabi?
In 2014, I think, the summer, my sister gave me a call and said my mother had been taken to the hospital and it was emergency surgery. Could I come? At the time, I was looking for work. I'd just finished art school. I was on a student visa. I needed work in order to continue to stay in the States. And I hesitated. And then my sister did something that was really kind, but I knew she was lying. She said, Amma, which is the Malayalam word for mother, would want you to stay. Because if I left the States, then I wouldn't have a place to go to or return to. So I chose to stay because I was an idiot. And then when my mother was taken into surgery, I waited. And it was terrible. I mean, the guilt hasn't left me to this day. When my paperwork came through, I went to see my mom, and New York University Abu Dhabi had been mentioned to me. And because I'm not trained in academia, I just did the one daft thing no one should really do. I found a professor there who wanted to meet me, and I said, what do I have to do to get a job here? And she said, well, there's a vacancy in my department, and I basically conned my way into academia. I returned for my mother. I returned because I was sorry. That's why I went back.
Your parents would have retired from work now. Are they still able to stay in the UAE?
No, they left last year, after 45 years. And so they left in the summer.
Where have they gone?
They've gone back, I say gone back, they've been returned to Kerala. And that's where they are. I mean, they can visit. We have to apply for a visit visa. But it felt the most practical thing to do, simply because you have to insure your family members if they're wedded to your visas. And it was getting too expensive. And it was my mother who actually said, it's time to go. And it broke my heart when she said it, because my sibling and I were trying to figure out how to say it to them. Maybe it's time to go. But I think she understood that, so she spared us that interaction.
And how are things for your mum and dad in Kerala?
They're adjusting. I think my father finds it a little bit more difficult because he's bored out of his mind. My mother, basically orders my father around, so I think she likes that part of the equation because she's in charge now. But it's an adjustment. It's also an adjustment for us because now I have to go see them periodically. I have to do what my parents did when their parents were alive.
Deepak, it's an incredible window I feel you've invited us to look through into your home and your family. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Very, very generous, and thank you all.
This conversation with the writer Deepak Unnikrishnan was recorded in front of an audience at the recent Perth Writers Festival. The conversation will be up on our website shortly, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.